Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Wednesday, the 7th of August, these are our main stories. The acclaimed Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison has died aged 88. We'll be looking back at her life and hearing from those who knew her. A peace deal has finally been signed in Mozambique, almost 30 years since the end of the Civil War. And the US has placed further sanctions on Venezuela's government in an attempt to topple President Nicolas Maduro. Also in this podcast...
This is my first sentence, and I also expected it to be more violent and more tense, but it surprised me that it's actually quite calm. It's a very calm prison. It also has a good environment between prisoners and guards.
We'll hear about how Norway's prison officers train to be more than just guards, and how not to get rid of your old fridge. The celebrated Nobel Prize-winning author Toni Morrison has died at the age of 88. Not only was she the first ever African-American woman to win the Nobel Prize for Literature, but she also won the Pulitzer Prize and became the first black female editor of Random House. Toni Morrison's work focused on slavery, the experience of the black community, especially women, and the continuing racial prejudice in the US. Our arts correspondent Vincent Dowd looks back at her life and work.
A decade ago, Toni Morrison explained how it had felt to depict the lives of America's African slaves in her novel, A Mercy.
My job was so easy compared to theirs. All I had to do was think about it, write about it, and try to feel it. I didn't have to live it.
The core of Morrison's success came in giving a sense of life lived in America by black men and women in her own time and earlier. Chloe Wofford, her original name, was born in Lorain, Ohio. Her father was a welder. She soon realised her family life was not reflected in books.
What I felt was that vacancy about our story, my story, you know, that wasn't anywhere, because I was a very avid reader, and the book wasn't there. And if it had been, I think I probably wouldn't have been a writer at all. I would just remained a reader.
She went to college and headed into an academic career, but she made the jump to publishing and encouraged black authors. Reaching 40, Toni Morrison started her own writing career. Probably the best-known novel remains Beloved, which came out in 1987.
I didn't have time to explain before because it had to be done quick. She had to be safe, and I put her where she would be. But my love was tough.
Toni Morrison was now a major American author, read around the world. In 1993, the Nobel Prize for Literature made her the first black female laureate in any category. Morrison was always resolute in her independence. She recalled the slogan, "Black is beautiful," which she considered trite and condescending.
Is that what makes us human? Acceptable? It was part of what I really despised, which was addressing white people. No, I know I'm beautiful. I'm not talking to white people. I'm talking in my books. I'm reading them. So I'm talking to me, which means I'm talking to black people.
At news of her death, former President Barack Obama said of Toni Morrison in a tweet, "Her writing was a beautiful, meaningful challenge to our conscience and our moral imagination."
That was Vincent Dowd. But what was Toni Morrison like for those who knew her? Paul Henley spoke to poet and author Nikki Giovanni, someone who was a good friend of Toni Morrison for over 40 years.
When I received a call this morning that Toni had transitioned, tears just flew out of my eyes. I am incredibly sad. And I mean no quarrel. I mean actually just being sad. But, you know, Toni hasn't left us. Toni has no more left us than Shakespeare has left us, than Jesus has left us. She will always be with us, and she will always be alive with us, and her stories will always be alive, because any great storyteller, which Toni was, any great truth teller, which Toni was, and in terms of friends, one day I too will transition, and with any luck, I'll get to visit with Toni. But because she's going to heaven. I always know I'm going to hell because I dislike so many people. But it's just she has not left us. And so when we say, you know, what does it mean to literature? What she has given to literature is a seed that will continue to grow.
How did you first meet?
Because she's one of the two writers, actually, that I tracked. When I read The Bluest Eye, I lived in New York. I lived on 92nd Street, and she was an editor at Random. I read The Bluest Eye, and it was like, I want to meet this person. And so what I did was I walked from 92nd all the way down to Random House, and I got there, and they had a guard then. You know, it wasn't as crazy as it is now, but they had a guard, and the guard is like, what can I do for you? And I said, I want to meet Toni Morrison. And he said, is she expecting you? And I said, no. Does she know you? I said, I don't think so. And he said, well, can I have your name? And I gave him my name, and she came down, and we went to a coffee shop, and I was thrilled that she actually knew something. She knew my work, some of my work at least.
You successfully stalked her, didn't you, effectively?
I stalked her, yeah. I actually did, and I wanted my book signed. I wanted a first edition signed. And we became friends because I guess the term would be fell in love. I just thought, most fascinating writer. We continued to be friends. I adored her.
Nikki Giovanni talking about her friend, Toni Morrison, who's died aged 88. 27 years ago, Mozambique's civil war came to an end, but it took until Tuesday for an official peace deal to be signed. It was President Filipe Nyusi and the leader of the former rebel group RENAMO who signed the treaty. During the conflict, more than 1 million people were killed. Our Africa editor Will Ross explained why it took so long to get to this point.
The differences between the former rebel group RENAMO and the government have really gone on for many years. And after the peace deal, the initial one in 1992, there were elections, several elections that RENAMO kept losing. They felt that some of those elections were rigged. They also felt that they weren't getting a sort of fair slice of the economic pie, as it were, of the country. So some of them went back to the bush. And ever since then, really, there have been skirmishes, and they got much worse in about 2014, 15 and 16. So then there's been a renewed attempt to try and bring about a final peace deal. And that's come after some negotiation. And it's been seen as a very important step to try and help the country really move to a different democratic level, because things have been getting worse in recent years with this violence, and elections are coming up in October.
So this deal has been signed. What are the key elements in it?
Well, the key elements really are that those people who are still in the bush, the fighters, and there are believed to be several hundred of them, they will be integrated into the military or back into civilian life. So they've already agreed a ceasefire and an amnesty is in place. And the key thing really is that these people are now promised, according to the deal, a new life, whether that's working with the National Army or as civilians. And that the hope is that that will take away the kind of temptation to stay in the bush and carry on fighting.
So what sort of reaction has there been to the signing?
I think, you know, many Mozambicans are hopeful that this is going to hold and this will finally be a deal that will lead to peace that will go on and on. But the challenge or the concern is there's another conflict going on in the north of the country, an Islamist-backed conflict, a rather deadly one that's happening in very remote areas. And there is always the possibility of flare-ups of violence again. So October, the elections, is the key.
That was Will Ross. The United States has put further pressure on Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro to step down. Washington will freeze all the Venezuelan government's assets in the US, and there'll be sanctions on anyone who provides support for the Maduro government. The US and many other countries support the head of the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, who declared himself president in January. Speaking from Lima, Peru, this is how Mr. Guaido responded.
Producto. As a result of the protection of assets, the first thing we should say is that today, what we've been fighting for is guaranteed, which is saving Venezuela's overseas assets to be able to use them in Venezuela's recovery. That's the first thing we have to say to the Venezuelan people. The second is that these sanctions aren't against Venezuela. They are against a regime and against those that do business at the expense of Venezuelans' hunger.
Venezuela's government has condemned the move and called it another act of serious aggression. Elliot Abrams is the US State Department Special Representative for Venezuela. He's at the same conference in Lima. So what change does he think these sanctions will bring?
We are hoping that they will bring more pressure on the regime. Obviously, the pressure that the whole international community has marshaled so far has not been enough to bring a return to democracy in Venezuela. And the hope is that, as the Colombian foreign minister said at the gathering here, more sanctions, more sanctions, more sanctions, he said it three times, will produce the effect that we all want, which is the beginning of a democratic transition. The sanctions only affect the government, the regime, and we have very carefully given all sorts of licenses to guarantee that it doesn't affect that the sanctions don't affect the people. There are always exceptions for humanitarian goods, humanitarian organizations, NGOs. The regime, if it wanted to, could buy food and medicine in the United States any time. But what we know is that they are misusing the assets that they do have, the gold they're selling, the oil they're giving to Russia and China, instead of using those assets for the people of Venezuela. These sanctions don't cause them to do that. The hope is that they will cause the regime to stop doing that.
Elliot Abrams, the U.S. State Department Special Representative for Venezuela. There has been widespread outrage after a photo surfaced of two white mounted police officers in Texas who tied a rope around a black suspect and led him through the city of Galveston. The Galveston chief apologized but said the officers did not have malicious intent. Charlotte Gallagher reports.
The photos have shocked and appalled many. They show two white officers on horseback leading a black man behind them, a rope around his wrists. For some, the images evoke America's dark past of segregation, slavery and lynching. The man has been named as 43-year-old Donald Neely. He was arrested in the city of Galveston on Saturday for trespass. Officers apparently made the decision to lead him by horse because a patrol car wasn't available. Today, the chief of Galveston Police issued a statement apologising to Mr. Neely for the unnecessary embarrassment and said his officers would no longer detain suspects in that way. The case coincides with a national discussion of how police in the US treat black people. Some social media users have said the white man accused of mass murder in El Paso was treated with more dignity than a black man accused of trespass.
Charlotte Gallagher. Still to come in this podcast.
They look a little bit like a cross between an armadillo and a dinosaur, or maybe a weaponized caterpillar.
And now thousands of them have been scattered across the moon after an Israeli spacecraft crash landed. For the fourth time in 2 weeks, North Korea has fired short-range missiles into the sea. The response from the United States, though, has been restrained. Here's the Defense Secretary, Mark Esper, speaking on a flight to Japan.
The key is to keep the door open for diplomacy. The president had a good meeting last month or so with President Kim Jong-un, and we're not going to overreact to these, but we monitor them, we watch them closely, and we're cognizant of what's happening.
And the U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton says Donald Trump and Kim Jong-un have an understanding that Pyongyang will not launch longer-range intercontinental ballistic missiles. These latest developments come as the U.S. and South Korea are holding their regular military exercises. Our Korean service editor is Soomin Hwang.
The joint drills between the U.S. and Korea have been ongoing every single year, and it's not unusual for North Korea to express some sort of irritation and express that in a military aggressive way. However, what makes this interesting is last year we've seen the relationship thawing, North Korea even saying that they won't launch any more intercontinental ballistic missiles. Now, North Korea is, in a way, threatening that, look, we've promised this, but you might not get this anymore.
Now, it's interesting because John Bolton on Fox TV has said today that Trump and Kim have an understanding and that North Korea won't fire a long-range missile. North Korean TV, though, has been saying that North Korea will not be constrained. Two quite different messages.
What we're seeing here is there's a very subtle negotiation going on between the two countries. Although on the surface, it may seem like North Korea is actively threatening them and behaving in a very aggressive way, it has always held on to that thread of conversation. And even in the very recent statement regarding this incident, it has said that it will maintain the position of solving the issue through conversations. What also we need to remember is that when North Korea fires such missiles, it's got two audiences. One is to the US and South Korea, giving its warning, but also it's a message for North Koreans itself. Last year, Kim Jong-un has promised its people the economic revival. However, he did not get that yet. The sanctions have been increased, which had put a lot of strain on the economies of North Korea. So in a way, Kim Jong-un is saying to its people, look, I'm still a powerful leader, and although the economic sanctions may have posed some difficulties, I still have this negotiating asset.
That was Soo-min Hwang. Now, if you've been paying attention to the Global News podcast recently, you might have heard a report about Norway's justice model, which focuses on rehabilitation rather than retribution. When Norway moved away from a punitive lock-up approach 20 years ago, it sharply reduced the number of inmates who re-offend after release. Part of that success has been put down to its overhaul of prison officers. They train for at least 2 years and now serve as mentors and role models for prisoners rather than simply guards. Emma-Jane Kirby has been to Lillestrøm near Oslo, where all Norwegian prison guards train.
The training prisons, yeah. Because it looked like prison cells.
Gosh.
And you can also walk upstairs and look into it.
A replica prison block at the University College of the Norwegian Correctional Service, where prison officer trainees get a taste of what's to come.
I can see some riot gear over there, yes. Some helmets. And
they have to train to use it.
They do, of course, get security and riot training as part of their instruction. But as director Hans-Jørgen Brücke explains, this is only a tiny part of their course.
We want them not just to be guards. They have law. The law of being in prison and how to treat prisoners. They have community reintegration and social work and criminology. They also have knowledge and ethics.
How long have you been
in prison now? I've been in prison for 4 months.
Trainee prison guard Jon Fredrik Andersen, flanked by experienced officer Linn Andreasen, has just started a year's placement at Halden High Security Prison. In the UK, prison officers are trained in just 3 months. Jon Fredrik's training will take 2 to 3 years.
Right now, I don't feel ready for all the things this kind of job puts you into. So I think 3 months sounds like, well, how can you learn to treat people in crisis in 3 months?
We like to use the term officer because a guard is just a part of it. You have to be a psychologist, you have to be a helper in every kind of way. You have to think about how you say things, why you're saying things. We have to be a role model for the inmates.
Take your big toes together, your bum behind.
At the open-air yoga class, barefoot murderers and drug smugglers and their prison officers obediently stretch into child's pose at the instructor's command.
Okay. Just breathe.
Halden's governor, Ara Hudal, explains prison officers here have to be actively involved in the inmates' lives.
Okay, it's okay.
We are together all day with inmates, all day, from morning until evening. We call that dynamic security. We are together with them in a positive way.
Getting back, 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 back. And then you're putting your arms forward.
The dynamic security seems to keep things calm.
We don't have violence. We don't have violence against officers. We have some incident where the inmate is spitting on the officers. But we have some threats, of course, but fighting against officers, we don't have that.
This is my first sentence and possibly my only one. And I also expected it to be more violent and much more tense. But it surprised me that it's actually quite calm. It's a very calm prison. It also have a good environment between prisoners and guards.
That's Kim, who's serving 17 years for murder. He's one of 258 inmates here, and there are 290 prison staff. That's officers, teachers and workshop tutors working around him. Kim's a little ambivalent about the close contact system.
They try to interact. Some prisoners likes it, some prisoners don't. It's a good thing that you interact, but not too much. Because you always have that, even though I'm a prisoner, also skeptical to guards. Like, how much can I trust you? What will you do if I open up myself? Will you use it against me later on? Stuff like this. So, yeah. It is kind of a two-edged sword, if you can say it like this. Yeah.
That was one of Norway's prisoners. Ending that report by Emma-Jane Kirby. Now, if you plan on getting rid of any kitchen appliances anytime soon, you might want to think carefully about how you dispose of them. A man in Spain who was filmed throwing a fridge down a ravine and joking about recycling probably wishes he had. Our Europe regional editor Mike Sanders has been looking at the video that began the downward spiral.
Reciclando. Vamos a reciclarla.
This is the soundtrack of the moment Mario heaved a fridge over a roadside barrier and sent it tumbling down a hillside. The video, shot by his associate, soon surfaced on social media. Police from Seprona, the nature protection unit in Almeria in southern Spain, had little trouble tracking him down. His van's registration plates were clearly visible. Officers made them both go back to the ravine and haul the fridge and a discarded washing machine up to the roadside and away. To add to the humiliation, they filmed them doing it and posted the footage alongside the original video. The firm Mario worked for is also in trouble. Officers found 70 old appliances stored there with no record of any proper disposal for the past 10 years. Each offence could entail a fine of up to $50,000, not to mention the social opprobrium. Mario told a newspaper that he'd gone into hiding to avoid the backlash. He said he'd been pilloried worse than killers, thieves or politicians.
Mike Sanders reporting. An Israeli spacecraft which crash-landed on the moon contained a bank of information including DNA samples and thousands of tardigrades, which are now stranded up there. But what are tardigrades? Chloe Tilley spoke to Nova Spivak, who founded the Arch Mission Foundation. The DNA bank on the lander was one of their projects. He spoke to her from Beijing.
Tardigrades are perhaps the most durable form of life that can survive practically any type of planetary apocalypse that you can throw at them. They're microscopic. They look a little bit like a cross between an armadillo and a dinosaur, or maybe a weaponized caterpillar. They are multicellular, and they are capable of going into a state of suspended animation. And in fact, they can even survive in space in that state.
And so that is why you decided to send them up to the moon in this project. Just explain what the project was.
Well, the Arc Mission Foundation is archiving the heritage of our planet. Essentially, we are building a backup of planet Earth, both our knowledge and our biology. And we are distributing that around the solar system in multiple redundant locations, including on Earth, so that it can never be lost. We've sent four missions to space so far. The first one was with Elon Musk in the glove compartment of his Tesla, which is now orbiting the sun for 30 million years. We also put the Wikipedia in orbit around Earth. Then we landed, or I should say crash-landed, a 30-million-page lunar library on the moon with SpaceIL in April. In that mission, we also included life, which is the tardigrades, as well as the DNA of 25 people.
Well, let's talk about that, because the thing you mentioned there in passing was it crashed. And I guess that's the kind of significant element here, isn't it? Because what does that mean?
Yeah, minor detail.
Does that mean that these things are now released on the moon? Just tell us the reality of it.
We calculated the impact and other parameters of that landing, and it would not be sufficient to destroy the lunar library. So we believe the lunar library is intact somewhere on the moon. That said, the DNA and organisms, the tardigrades and so forth, were encapsulated inside this artificial amber. A small amount of the tardigrades were also outside the resin in a special little 1 centimeter patch that was inside the payload. In the impact, either the payload is completely intact or it was fragmented into a couple of pieces. Either way, that would not destroy tardigrades.
So can they breed on the moon?
No. The tardigrades are in suspended animation. They're actually sort of dehydrated and frozen in time. They would need to be, first of all, located on the moon. Then they would need to be exfiltrated from the moon to a location with a suitable atmosphere. And then in that location, they would need to be rehydrated, at which point they could be reanimated and come back to life. So they can't move around. They can't reproduce. They're not eating moon rock. The cheese is safe.
You heard the man. The cheese is safe. I know, I'm reassured. Nova Spivak was speaking to Chloe Tilley. And that's it from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you would like to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, do please send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and I'll leave you with a thought from Toni Morrison. Something that is loved is never lost. Until next time, goodbye.